Invite you to turn to the book of Esther, chapter 4. I'll be reading from verses 4 to 14. As you're turning there, the beginning of the week, I had my blood work to check out where things are at with me, and the results came back that at this point my kidneys are holding stable. And so I thank you again for your prayers. But the lab that I went to was the first time that I've ever been to that lab, and the lady that took the blood work, or took my blood, as we began to converse with each other, I started to wonder, is she a believer? And the longer we conversed, the more she confirmed it. You know, and one thing that she said, I'm amazed that, she said, the life is in the blood. She said, I'm amazed at all the tests that can be did with the blood and what you can find out just through the blood. It is amazing. But it points to a great God. A great God. He's on your side and my side this morning. I'm glad I'm on his. Are you? It was interesting that the last, when we, when she was done, and I barely felt the prick, and that means a lot to me in getting all these blood tests, she was good. And but at any rate, when we parted ways, she said it was good to meet a brother. You know, those kind of things kind of make your day. They kind of make your day. God is so good to us. Esther 4, beginning of verse 4. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai, and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Then called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. So Hatak went forth to Mordecai onto the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Also he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him, and to make request before him for her people. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Again Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there was one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? All who are able, we would ask that you would kneel for prayer.
We extend greetings to you in our Lord's name this morning. We would like to look at I guess what we could term a character study of Esther. Esther, I would consider one of the more prominent female characters in the Bible. And perhaps in looking at all the messages that ministers might give over a period of a lifetime, perhaps in all of that there is not as much emphasis on female character studies as there could be. And I would hope this morning that we can all learn from this, but I think there's a special blessing or interest from the females among us in this character study, and rightly so. Esther is important in the Jewish faith as well, because the story of her life here, as it's recorded in Esther, produced one of the festivals that the Jews still observe today. And I had the privilege of working with two Jews over a period of a couple years, and had the opportunity to ask them questions about the Feast of Purim and this story of Esther and Haman, and what it means in the Jewish tradition, and what it means for the children. And it was interesting to hear, as they related it, it was one of the festivals that they could remember as children, that they really looked forward to, and they enjoyed it. Because, so I asked the question, well, why did you enjoy it? Well, one of the things that they enjoyed was the fact that whenever Haman's name was mentioned, everyone would boo, and they go shh, and they'd stomp their feet. And so there were ways that the Jews used to convey the different characters that were represented in the life of Esther. And so we just want to take sort of like an overview of her life and an overview of the book, and draw some parallels for our own lives. We want to notice the circumstances and the perspectives that shaped her life. There's much about her life that we do not know, and so we draw information and conclusions based upon the things that are recorded in Scripture that have come to define her character and her legacy. Her background is that of a captive from Israel and brought into the foreign country of Persia. And then she lost her parents, so she became an orphan. And then her older cousin, who in the Scriptures here is referred to as Mordecai, becomes her surrogate father and raises Esther as his own daughter. We're not told much about the hardships she may have faced as a Jew, dealing with the grief and the loss of her parents, and perhaps even the general acceptance that she would have felt in society as at large. The Jews would have, in the Persian Empire, would have, depending on who the backgrounds of other peoples were, may or may not have been very well accepted. We see that in the book of Esther, that there certainly were enemies of the Jews in the empire. She could easily have felt like her life was ruined with the passing of her parents and have become bitter. But from this background, we can understand how the circumstances that she could not control played a significant role in shaping her life for the plan that God had for her. I want to repeat that. The circumstances that played a very significant role in shaping her life were circumstances that she could not control, but yet they played a major role in unveiling God's plan for her life. With Mordecai becoming her surrogate father, and he serving in the role of in the king's court, we can see that God used the death of her parents to bring her into the role of the queen, but she also remained connected to her Jewish heritage through Mordecai, because he was also a statesman. And with him being a statesman, there was the ability for that interchange to support her status as a queen and helping her make the right decisions that she faced. And so these are some of the circumstances that God brought into her life that she had no control over. The only thing that she could do was make a choice in how she would respond to those circumstances that were in her life. Her name at birth, given to her by her parents, was Hadassah, and that means myrtle or myrtle tree. The myrtle tree is used in Scripture in connection with Israel's promised blessing after a time of hardship. The symbol comes into prominence in connection with the Jews' return from captivity and also their promise as a restoration to their land. And it's a sign of their future blessing and peace. And it's used that way in Zechariah chapter 1, verses 7 through 11, where Zechariah gives a prophecy and he uses the example or the illustration of the myrtle in order to represent the future blessings of God's people. It's interesting also that in Nehemiah chapter 8, verses 15 and 18, that myrtle branches were used to celebrate the Feast of the Booths after their return from captivity. What is significant about this is because myrtle is not mentioned among the trees that were used in Leviticus 23, verse 40, as the trees that were used to celebrate the Feast of Booths. But when they return from captivity, there's specific instruction mentioned or narrative mentioned in Nehemiah that they used the myrtle branch to celebrate the Feast of Booths or Feast of Tabernacles. And so it was a symbol of them coming back into their land after captivity, that God was with his people and that there would be a time of rest or restoration after a time of great difficulty. And so Esther's life is symbolized by Hadassah. God's plan for her life was to be the myrtle branch. God would use her after a time of hardship to bring life and restoration to her people, the Jews. And so we see how God uses that name that's given her. Now, Hadassah, as a physical girl, was beautiful. And I think it's fair to say that the desire of females is to be beautiful at least in one person's eyes in their lifetime. But she's recognized by many as being beautiful, and she's chosen above all others to be the new bride of the king. And perhaps in modern way of thinking, well, I shouldn't even say modern way of thinking, but in a female way of thinking, that would be someone that you would look up to and you would desire, if I could just be someone like her, how much better my life would be if people would recognize me as someone who is beautiful. Being brought to be the new bride of the king based on her beauty, we could say with a play on words that she was the beauty queen. We could also say that she had a great opportunity at stardom. Her life could completely change by becoming the queen of Persia, Persia being the most powerful nation on earth at that time, and the king of Persia obviously being the most powerful man on earth at that time. Her name given to her in Persian is Esther, and it means a star. The fact that she was given a Persian name is seeming indicator that it was a sign of her status change from a commoner as Hadassah to royalty being Esther. And out of the many candidates, she's selected to be the lucky one. But remember, for a Jewish girl who wanted to be faithful, her beauty could have been to her as a trial. To be selected for marriage to a pagan king just on the basis of physical beauty alone was not something that a Jewish girl would have looked forward to, especially to an older pagan king, a young Jewish girl. Plus, the king also had a harem of women, could have also had a couple other wives, as Persian kings typically did. They often had up to five wives, one of which was the queen, and then there were many other courtesans in the harem of women. And so to look at it from the aspect of this girl had everything going for her because she was beautiful, actually within her Jewish faith background, this would have been a huge difficulty to understand how God would allow this to happen in my life. I'm sure as a young Jewish girl, she would have rather have had a relationship with one young man who loved her than to be married to a pagan king who was much older and who also had many women. But now she needs to make a decision. She now has two names and she needs to decide where her character identity lies, because it would almost seem that those two names represent two persons. The one person connects her, or the one name, Hadassah, connects her to her heritage of faith, to her people. The other name that is given to her represents her position that is conveyed upon her by a king. And she soon is faced to make decisions about her faith, about her people, about her future privileges, and about her own personal safety. All of these events in her life are beyond her control. She only has one choice to make in relation to all of these circumstances, and that is, how will she respond? What attitude will she adopt in relation to the many things in her life that she cannot control? We often don't know how God may use hard choices in our life to unveil and to also fulfill his plan for our lives. And we need to examine ourselves before we make those hard choices. Esther would not have needed to risk her life if she left her faith and her people behind her. With her parents gone, it would have been easier to adopt her new role as Queen Esther and to ignore the advice of Mordecai. Because after all, she had a higher station than Mordecai. But he continues to give her advice even after she is a queen, and she needs to make a decision whether she will heed that advice. Now, he had told her early on not to reveal her heritage, not to reveal who she was. If she had not heeded that advice, she possibly would have lost the element of surprise later when she reveals her identity to the king and to Haman. In fact, we know that she would have lost the element of surprise. And I believe that that was essential, or a necessary part or important part of that conversation between Haman and the king as she reveals her identity. It's in all of us to want to be accepted for who we truly are. And so for the king, for her finding favor in the eyes of the king, the question could have been in the back of her mind: if he knew I was a Jewess, would I still find favor in his eyes? Because without being able to reveal her identity, she never really knew the answer to that question. But she obeyed the advice of Mordecai. She kept her past a mystery in order to fulfill God's plan for her life. You see, her obedience to her surrogate father, her older cousin, was how God chose to reveal his plan for her. The first advice that she's getting is not God directly speaking to her or God revealing his plan for her life, but rather it's coming through the advice of another godly person in her life. In chapter 4, verse 8, Mordecai charges Esther to go into the king and to plead for her people, identifying them as her people, connecting her still to her faith and her people. He doesn't say merely the Jews, but he identifies them as her people. And he's also asking her to go against the former advice of hiding her identity and to reveal her identity. And so timing is important in God's revealing of his plan for our life. Sometimes in timing, God asks us not to do something, which in later time, God may ask us to do it because it serves his purposes as his timing comes into play or comes into importance. And so we see the importance of recognizing the timing of God in our lives. Well, let's notice some of the important points from some of the key verses here in the book of Esther. Verse 13 in chapter 4. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Mordecai commands Esther, and Esther is the queen. If they would have not had a close relationship up to this point in time, if Mordecai would not have had the complete trust of Esther, but because of their relationship as a father and a daughter, and because she knew that Mordecai had basically invested his life into her life, he earned the right in her life to be a mentor. And so when he presents what he believes is God's direction for her life, let's pay attention to some of the principles that are in the verse that we just read, or the verses that we read. First of all, I think he's clearly saying, do not rationalize away God's direction for your life. Think not with thyself. In other words, do not rationalize this away. He also indicates that she is not to think that if she holds her peace at this time when God is asking her to speak, when God is asking her to step forward, when God is asking her to identify with her people, don't think that you're above the rest of God's people just because you enjoy a privilege that the rest of them do not enjoy. God may bring special circumstances in your life, but those special circumstances are never intended to separate you from God's people. Be willing to identify with God's people and even to die for your faith. Now, God often, when he speaks clearly to our lives, he has a plan that he intends to unfold. If he's speaking to us, he has a plan that he intends to unfold through our lives. But we should never suppose that God's plan will fail if we choose not to cooperate with God. And Mordecai brings that to Esther's attention. Don't think that if you hold your peace, that that's going to be the end. There's going to be enlargement and deliverance going to arise from another place. But that is not God's choice. That's not God's best choice as to how this is to happen. And so we ought never to think that we're that important that God's plan hinges upon us. Rather, when we refuse to cooperate with God's plan that does include us, there is always a consequence for rejecting God's will for our life. God controls the timing of his plan for our lives and often reveals the timing in the greatest tests. Esther was asked not to reveal her identity. Looking at it from a female perspective, you would think, well, there would be a much better time than a time like this to reveal my identity. I would like to do it in a situation where the stakes are not so high, with my own life and the life of my people. She could have rationalized that, but she chose to accept it.
If God is directing these circumstances, then he will also support me through them, and his eternal purposes will be accomplished through my willingness to obey. She made a decision to obey without knowing what the outcome would be. She had no assurance that the outcome would be favorable either to her or to her people. That is obvious in her response where she says, "If I perish, I perish." Are we willing to obey what God asks us to do without being able to predetermine what the outcome may be? That is the test of true obedience. Often what initially may appear as human guidance or a human mentor in our life might later be revealed as divine direction. Sometimes God speaks his will into our life through another trusted person. And we have to look at all of this within the context of Mordecai's words being God's will. So we might ask the question, how do we know if we should trust the advice of someone as being God's will for us? That's a difficult decision, to say that I will accept somebody else's advice as God's will for my life. Well, I think we should first ask whether the person who's giving us the advice is a trusted person. Esther knew that Mordecai was a trusted person. He was asking her to put her life at risk for her faith. But had he not already demonstrated that he was willing to put his life at risk for his faith? So we need to be careful in taking advice from someone if we don't already see their lives submitted to the will of God. Have you seen God work through them? Have you seen them being willing to do things very similar to what they are asking you to do? If the roles were reversed, would they be willing to take their own advice? Are they most concerned about God's plan being accomplished rather than fulfilling an agenda? When someone comes to us to give advice and it seems obvious that they have an agenda that they want to fulfill, but they want to use our lives as if under the guise, you could say, of having us fulfill what they think is God's will for our lives, we need to be careful. But it was very clear in this account that Mordecai's concern was for God's people in general, for God's people as a whole. And so when he asked Esther to place her life in peril, he had already demonstrated that he would be willing to put his own life in peril for the benefit of his people. But now we notice also how Esther responds to this. Chapter 4, verse 16, she says, "Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me. Neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so I will go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." So what do we see in her response to Mordecai? We see, first of all, that she's in a mutually trusted relationship. She not only has the freedom, or he not only has the freedom to give advice, but she also has the freedom to respond, and as a queen, to give not only advice, but also a command. It says later, "So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him." And so we see in this relationship that there was mutual respect. There was willingness to submit to one another. And so in a mentor relationship, where God brings someone into our life that God is using to develop our life, one of the tests of the character of that person is whether they will also accept advice back, whether they will also recognize that God could be speaking through you also back to them. In her response, she senses the need to band together with other saints. That this, although this task may be hers, it affects all of God's people, and she wants God's people involved in prayer and fasting. Jesus asked his disciples to pray with him in the garden when their salvation and the salvation of all mankind was at stake. And so she, in her response, she reaches out to God's people. She senses the need for divine aid. She mentions fasting. When fasting is used within the context of the Jews, it always indicates earnest prayer. There may be earnest prayer in the life of a Jew, but if fasting accompanies it, it takes prayer to another level. And so the only thing that a Jew needs to indicate in order to pray is by indicating fasting, they mean both earnest prayer and also to the point where I'm willing to deny myself. Because as a Jew would fast and as their physical strength diminishes, the idea is that we sense our own helplessness and we cast ourselves upon the strength of God. And so the humbling of self is pictured in fasting. And it's critical to the outcome because she's recognizing in fasting, and God's people are recognizing in fasting, that ultimately God's plan is not dependent upon Esther, but God's plan is dependent upon God himself. Now, in order to carry out her plan, she needs to break the normal protocol of Persian law, which says that she cannot go in and petition the king unless the king would first give permission for that. But when God's will is her ultimate desire, she recognizes that God himself can move heaven and earth to open up a way. And the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. And as the rivers of water, he can direct it how he chooses. And so she's willing to risk her life to obey what she senses is God's will for her, not knowing what the outcome may be. If she was to make a prediction about what the outcome could likely be, she could have looked at the former queen Vashti when the normal protocols were violated. Because of what happened to Queen Vashti, she knew that this king was not given to looking favorably on his protocols, on his culture being disregarded. Or we could say even his importance being disregarded. But she goes in before the king in his court. And she makes a request. And the king says, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request?" "It shall be given thee to the half of the kingdom." And Esther answered and said, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." And so she asks, she comes and she makes that petition to the king. And in this request to come to the banquet, there at the first banquet, there's another request. And in the second request, she comes to the point of the real reason for the request to come to a meal. And so looking at what takes place there, let's notice some things about Esther. She goes into the public court, but she asks for a private meeting in order to present her request. She does not put the king in a difficult position before his court. It would have been very difficult for the king to know how to respond if the request would have been made publicly in court before all his advisors. And so she's showing wisdom both in their marital relationship and also in the affairs of the state. By making the request for a private party at her garden, with just her and Haman, she prolongs the suspense by asking for that private meeting. And as a result of prolonging the suspense, she builds anticipation as to what this request will be. When the king and Haman come, They are anticipating. And when the second request comes for the next party, the request is even built higher. And you can see that as in the narrative as describes Haman. Because God uses this period of time to build up Haman's pride and to blind him by his pride and to cause him to be overly confident. And so when she comes to the point in the second meal, because he has been blinded by pride and because this anticipation has been built, two things happen. Haman is taken by surprise, and the king is even more ready to respond to his wife's request. We might ask, why does she ask for Haman to be present when she makes this difficult request? Would it not have been easier to make this request without the presence of Haman? First of all, it shows her credibility when it's performed in front of Haman. She has nothing to hide. She's willing to reveal the situation in front of the one who's the enemy of her people. It also shows her wisdom in knowing that if the king and Haman could talk about this alone, Haman would have the ability to influence the king. But when it happens all in front of her, because she reveals it in front of Haman, he doesn't have that ability to influence the king outside of her presence. And by coming to the point openly in front of Haman, she startles him. And he reacts before he can scheme to cleverly cover up that plot. And so he becomes revealed. It's interesting also her approach. She first pleads for her life and her people's lives before she reveals Haman as the plotter. She's actually getting the king's sympathy before she reveals who the enemy is. David used this same approach Nathan, the prophet, used the same approach when he approached David about adultery and murder. He told him the story of a sheep, the poor man who only had one sheep. And he got David's sympathy and commitment to make this wrong right before he said, "You are the man." And so by the approach that Esther took, she got the commitment and support of the king before she revealed who the enemy was. It's very clear that God blessed Esther with a lot of wisdom, with a lot of understanding. But I think it's also clear that God was guiding her life. She would not have wanted to face these circumstances on her wisdom alone. And the fact that she asked for fasting and prayer clearly indicates that she was not relying on her own insight, her own women's intuition, although it's very clear that she had plenty of that. And we look at all of this and we say, this is a wonderful story. But why is God's name missing from this book? In fact, this has caused some people to question the inspiration of the book of Esther. Should we assume that this book is not inspired because we don't see God's name in it? It's not mentioned. It's never indicated that God specifically speaks to Mordecai or to Esther. What can we learn from the seeming silence of God in our lives? I think there is a lesson that we can learn, and that is this. One of the lessons that we can learn is there are times in our lives where it seems like God does not speak directly to us, and we would like him to speak directly to us, but God is speaking to us through other people, through other trusted people. Are we open to receive God's direction for our lives through other trusted people? That's how Esther's life unfolded. Are we willing to accept our circumstances that we cannot control as the right circumstances for our life in order for God to develop his plan for us? She made that choice to accept that. Are we willing to believe that we are here on this earth for such a time as this, that the timing of God is right and the circumstances are right for God's plan for our life? Are we open to hearing God speak to us through others? Are we willing to sacrifice our lives for the fulfillment of God's plan for his people? Are we willing to make the I small? If I perish, I perish. She made the I small, and as a result, God was able to use her for a much larger plan. Now we have Esther, or Hadassah, we might say, represented by two names. We could say Hadassah represents God's will for her life because it came through her parents, and it seems to give us a picture of what God had planned for her life. But yet we see her being called by the name Esther. And often when we could say it this way, in Hadassah and in Esther, there's seemingly a contradiction. The one comes from her faith heritage. The other comes from a pagan heritage. The one comes from God speaking to her and God using her. The other comes through the influences of the world and how the world would use her life. Should she choose between those two names? Another way of looking at it is the one represents her history and the other represents her future. But God was able to bring both of those names together. Both her history and her future came together. Neither were mutually exclusive, one from the other. And so when God is taking us into a new development of our life, it's never for the intent of forgetting our history. Our history is what has brought us to the point where God is ready to open up our future before us. God uses our history and our future together to shape his plan for our lives. We have another man in Scripture who we see this happening to. His name was Simon and then Peter. And Jesus alternately calls him by either of those names. So this young lady was Hadassah to her people, the myrtle symbol of hope and blessing. But she was also the Persian queen Esther, a star whom God used to shine light into a pagan world of darkness and intrigue. The plots that went on in a Persian palace. We have a small understanding of what we can see in the book of Esther of some of the plots and the murder and the intrigue that takes place. We know from history that it was very common that in a Persian palace, there was intrigue and plots among the harem. There was intrigue and plots between the counselors of the court, vying for authority, vying for more prestige or more favor of the king. And in all of this, God put her in the middle of this. And she's guided by the silent and unseen hand of providence. And as a result of her self-sacrifice and her obedience, God blessed her with wisdom, and God used her in those circumstances. She chose the right perspective, and she's left behind us, for us, an inspiring legacy.
We've been richly challenged this morning of how God works in our lives if we're open to his direction. And I think one great lesson that here we have for our sisters, we see here a godly woman who was under authority of her dad who raised her, her substitute dad, as God led through him. And I'm so thankful for here at Pleasant Hill that we have godly women who seek to be under the authority of their husbands under God. And I want to encourage you to remain faithful to that. I think in back of every godly man, there's a godly sister. Keep that in mind as you serve him. Let's stand together for prayer.